Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio, and welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here, and my guest today, Melinda Myers of Milwaukee, horticulture experience more than 30 years. She's written more than 20 gardening books, including books like Can't Miss Small Space Gardening. She hosts the nationally syndicated Melinda's Garden Moment television segments and the PBS television show Great Lakes Gardener. And she's always a welcome guest on Garden Talk. Great to have her along. We can talk about a whole host of things when she is our guest. So veggies or the fruit, flowers or the lawns or the trees, join in with your questions at 1-800-642-1234. Email at talk@wpr.org. Melinda, welcome.
Larry, it's always good to chat with you and your listeners.
Well, I'll tell you what, you're a busy gal right now.
Yeah, well, this is the time of year when a lot of us are looking at what's new and what's different, what's coming up, so we can be prepared to help all the gardeners out there, and of course, to look for some new things to try in our own gardens. And I'm in West Chicago today at the Ball Horticultural Company, and they're having their Customer Appreciation Day, and they're showing off some of their new introductions that'll be coming out in 2011, some tried and true, and a lot of people may be going, Ball Horticulture? Well, if you know Wave Petunias, you know Ball Horticulture. They're the group that introduced that whole collection. And believe it or not, this is their 15th year of the Wave Petunias. So they've got the traditional Wave. They got the new improved Wave. They've got Tidal Wave. And and Shock Wave is really a nice new one, some really beautiful additions. And I happen to have sitting next to me a former student of mine, Kristen McGuigan, who came to Ball Seed Company, we were just recollecting, 13 years ago.
Oh.
And I thought if we have a minute, she's got an exciting new petunia that's going to be new for 2011 that I thought your listeners would appreciate finding out. How do they come from the breeder and get into our hands? And if it's okay, I'm going to pass the phone to her for a minute.
Sure.
How bad for putting you on the spot, Larry.
Oh, that's fine.
but Kristen, Larry Mueller, and I'm going to give you the phone, and she'll tell you a little bit about her new surprise, the new surprise introduction they have for 2011.
Hi, Kristen.
Hi, Larry.
You got a new surprise for us.
We have a very exciting new surprise for you. We have the world's first ever black petunia. Call it black velvet.
Wow.
Yeah, it's a vegetative petunia, and we have the ease in vegetative material to be able to get our product to the market in a couple years of trialing. So we take this product and we screen it in the greenhouse for our grower, which is our first customer. And then we also subject it to different conditions outside so that it performs for the most important customer, which is the end consumer, the gardener.
Now, how do you get a black one?
How do you get a black one? I'm not the breeder. I might have skipped a class of Melinda's once in a while. It's not any GMO-type product. It's something that they use traditional breeding methods with to be able to, say, cross plant A with plant B to make plant C.
Well, it sounds exciting. And when will it be on the market?
This will be available next spring.
Oh, something to look forward to. Thank you, Kristen.
You're welcome.
Appreciate it very much.
You're welcome.
Well, Melinda, it's always great to be able to talk to you, but nice to talk to one of your former students.
I know. It was so exciting. I was here last night to start my tour of the garden. It's always a nice surprise to see a friendly, smiling face and to see what, you know, the younger professionals are doing and bringing to us. And a lot of gardeners are going, yeah, we've seen black before, and it's really just dark purple. This is really black. And they also have pinstripe, which has a yellow stripe in it. And, you know, there's thousands of petunias out there, but it's won some awards because of its uniqueness. So I just thought your listeners would really enjoy kind of getting a glimpse into what's new and coming up. And I have the pleasure of spending the day taking photos and getting excited and trying to figure out where I can make some more room for new plants in my yard, too.
And you'll have some of those photos up, I'm sure, on your website.
You bet. We'll post some in the photo gallery, and I'll be covering. I'm actually starting to do a better job of using Twitter and on my Facebook. So if you go to my website, sign up to be a fan, and then nudge me along if I don't communicate quickly enough.
Okay. Well, Bob in New Glarus has a question for you. So let's just turn to Bob. Hi, Bob. Thank you for calling.
I'm listening to the radio, and I'm getting a different
hearing us talk,
different
right?
Program.
Stereo.
Am I on?
Yeah, you're on. Go ahead.
Okay, sorry. Would you have Melinda discuss the difference or the application for Southern Wisconsin of long and short day onions?
You know, that's a really good question. What happens when we get, if you get onions that are, I always have to think, short day onions, they will set bulb too quickly, and then you don't get the large size. The long, I always have to think about this. We're going in the long days, mm-hmm. and you want them, and then what you'll get is you want them to set bulb after we have the longer days, so they set in fall. And I always have to think this through when mm-hmm. our day length is and when our long days happen.
Sure.
It's like mums or short days, so they set in the fall. So most of what's sold in the garden centers are onions that are suited for this area. And so it's just when you start doing like some of the Vidalia onions, those are typically more southern onions that will set. If we plant them here, they'll set bulb too soon, and then you end up with a problem with you pull them and harvest them and they've set bulb early in the season instead of later in the season, and so then you end up with just nothing to really eat and harvest. And I'm kind of doing a quick cheat sheet here to kind of look through. Actually, I'm looking through my month-by-month gardening, which I did right, but, you know, some of these things don't stick as well. And I always have to just double-check my long and short period of onions on that for that very reason. So that's why you want those that are suited for north. You usually don't see it in catalogs too often, that reference, very seldom, but usually they'll say for northern gardens. And so that's where you really want to look for those.
Okay, well, I do buy onion sets.
Right, and those are usually pretty good, too. I've not had any problems.
Well,
with what
I had to dig mine just this week because they were ready to dig. I mean, the tops were dying. My experience is if I leave them in the garden and we get a rainy week in July,
they rot.
I begin to rot.
Yeah, and one of the other problems with this year, if you notice everything with the heat we've had, that everything is just way in advance, too, and it may just be more of an issue with the weather versus the onions that you were using. If you bought them from a reliable garden center, I wouldn't be too concerned about it. If you bought them through a catalog, those places are usually a little bit better at telling you which ones you want to get versus the others to avoid. So that's why I'm thinking that you should. It's probably more weather-related unless you bought them from a new place.
Yeah, it's 2 or 3 weeks ahead.
Yeah, exactly. I'm seeing everything going in. We've had all the heavy rains, like you said, so it's good you pulled them. Were the bulbs good size?
No, not particularly. That's why I'm wondering.
You know, so the other thing with the heat we had, the extreme heat, sometimes did you get a lot of flowers forming on them?
Well, I usually go along and break those off.
Okay. But a lot of times when things are setting bloom, that's also an indication where they're putting energy, and you're right to pick off those flowers. But that tells me, too, that they were putting energy into reproductive versus storing it in the bulb. So even though you removed them, which was good that you did that, that's one of the issues that might have also led to that. And I think it's probably more weather-related than it was having the wrong type of onions.
There you go.
Is what you're saying that we should be aiming for the long day onions?
You know what? And I'm going through my head. So when we plant our onions and they're going to be harvesting, we're going to be going from the long days into the short days. So actually, we're going for the short day onions. Sorry. I had to get that right in my head, because if we get the long ones as the days lengthen, then we'd be harvesting them. So the short days are the northern ones.
Short days. There you go,
yeah.
Bob. Thanks a lot for
calling.
Thanks
so much for the call. Thanks for your patience, me working it through my logic here.
Let's go to Linda in Suamico next. Hi, Linda.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I have two questions about my raspberries. In the past, I've seen sometimes my berries will set the flowers and they start forming berries and then they'll dry up. And I always attributed that to the fact that it didn't get enough moisture. Well, this year, I'm sure they've had enough moisture, but some of the berries are still drying up. Do you have any idea why?
Yeah, a lot of times what we see, and especially in rainy years like this, there are two diseases, one anthracnose, the other cane blight, and what you'll often see is a purpling, sunken area on the stem. Sometimes you'll see some yellowing of the leaves, and a lot of times when they're disease-infested, you'll get dry, kind of dry, crumbly berries.
Yes.
And if that's what you're seeing, one of the things that I would do, and it usually is good enough, you can't change the weather, but you can kind of manage your pruning. So after harvest, prune out those canes that bore fruit because you know they're done. The summer ones, they're done. And then in the winter, do some thinning. If these are these ever-bearing or summer-bearing?
You know, I've got a conglomeration.
Okay.
I understand. From my cousin, and so I've got golden raspberries, I've got regular raspberries, I've got ever-bearing berries. I mean, I guess I've got a whole conglomeration of them.
Okay, I hear you. Well, one is, you know, if it's a fall-bearing or ever-bearing, the fall crop comes on the first-year cane, so the canes that sprout in the spring bear fruit in the fall. And some people will manage those just as a fall crop, and they'll cut those down or let the rabbits eat them over winter, and then they'll send up new stems, and they don't get a summer crop, but just a fall crop. It's usually earlier and larger. And then for the summer bearing, do the pruning as I recommended. So that first year, the canes come up, thin them in the winter to like 5 or 6 canes per foot. Then in the summer, prune them right back to ground level after harvesting. Opens it up, better airflow, better light penetration, and usually that's enough to take care and prevent the disease problem.
Is that also the same thing that I've noticed on some of the raspberries where the tip seems to wilt, and then it just actually falls off?
The cane, you mean, or the fruit itself?
No, the tip of the
berry?
Yeah.
Tip of the cane, I think she said.
Yeah, just the cane. It's
okay.
Not the fruit.
That might be
just
some.
The
there are some insect galls that burrow in there and cane borers that will burrow into the stem, and you'll see a swollen area on the stem. So they stop the flow of water and nutrients. You get the wilting, and that you may want to check, and then just prune that out. It's really the best solution for that. So you may have a couple of different things happening.
Good luck, Linda. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Anna in Richland Center, we're on to you now. Hi, Anna.
Hi, thank you. Back in June, I got a beautiful fuchsia hanging basket. It was pretty large and had just a ton of blooms on it. And the house is facing east, I believe, and I hung it on the front of the porch, and I thought it would get, you know, some shade or some sun in the morning and then shade for the rest of the day. But now it just looks horrible. It's all brown and dried up, and there's, like, no buds on it. And at one point, I moved it back to close to the house where it got pretty much complete shade. And I didn't know that or if I was watering it too much or too little. And I was wondering if there's any way I can save it.
Do you have any signs of life on it? Any green at all? Any green leaves on the stems? Or? She's looking out the window, I bet, aren't you?
No, actually, I'm not. I'm somewhere else.
Okay.
There's a little bit of green, but there's a lot of brown.
Yeah.
Okay, if the stems are pliable, there's a chance. If they're, you know, brittle and breaking and there's no green leaves, definitely prune off anything that's brittle and broken. Fuchsia-like partial shade, moist conditions. Mm-hmm. It has been so hot this year. Things like fuchsias that really like the moisture may need watering twice a day. I've noticed this year that a lot of the potting mixes that I've been dealing with seem to dry out very quickly. And so I've noticed things with the heat and the potting mixes that are drying out fast that I'm really watering a lot. And if I don't, things are getting crispy pretty fast. I was gone for a couple of days, and, you know, it's always hard to find a good plant sitter. So I came back to a few crunchy things myself that I'm trying to revive. And I have been able to, but I wouldn't give it up. I would keep it in shade, water thoroughly. Stick your finger down a couple inches. It should be just slightly moist like a damp sponge. Water it again. Make sure if there's a saucer. I always pull those saucers off so I get good drainage out the bottom. If you get flowers as they fade, dead head, because they will set fruit, which is kind of interesting, but not what you're looking for, and keep that energy going back into recovery. I wouldn't give up on it. You know, we gardeners like to put every effort into being successful, but prune off anything dead, watch your moisture. I'd keep it in shade. East is okay, but if it's getting some of that late morning heat, you know, it's been pretty hot pretty early in the day, and that's pretty tough on our fuchsias.
What about the fact that you have to water so much?
Fertilizing?
Fertilizing is what
yeah,
I was going to bring up.
Good point. Thanks for mentioning that, Larry. And I would use a slow-release fertilizer. The one problem is when your plants are under stress, sometimes when we fertilize, that can damage those tender roots. So if you use, you know, like a low nitrogen slow release, a melorganite, an osmocote, something that's going to be very low nitrogen and very slow release over a longer period, you won't damage the plant as it's trying to recover. And that'll encourage good steady growth rather than pushing growth when it's already struggling. So thanks for mentioning the fertilizer, Larry.
Anna, thank you.
How much water did you say?
Water it so it comes out the bottom. And then check it twice a day when it's really hot. Doesn't mean you water it twice a day, but check it twice a day. And you may need to be watering twice a day on really hot days. For sure, once a day, you're probably going to need to water.
All right.
Okay.
All right. Thanks, Anna. Thanks a lot for calling. Melinda Myers of Milwaukee, our guest today on this edition of Garden Talk. Jim Packard, our producer. I'm Larry Mueller on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Melinda Myers. I have her website up. It's, by the way, it's MelindaMyers.com, and Myers is M-Y-E-R-S, MelindaMyers.com. Boy, you've got a beautiful, beautiful website here.
Thank you. We've really been working on it a long time, and gardeners being so visual, we really, you know, I get to go out and travel a lot, and I have a wonderful team that works with me. And so, you know, as we see gardens, we like to take photos and share those and kind of inspire people. We've got audio tips. I added Melinda's Garden Moments audio, so we air in several areas, and then those are also posted. They're 54-second tips. So, you know, as you're out and about or if you're on the computer and, you know, we've got different topics and they're categorized. So we're really trying to get people excited about gardening, and I'd love to have people send me pictures of their gardens because I think, you know, we all like to look in each other's backyards for ideas, and so we're trying to get those posted in our photo gallery so that you can get inspired, you can share with other folks and kind of maybe inspire others as well.
Let's turn to Kate in Menasha next. Kate, hello.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I love your program.
Thank you.
I have a question about very lacy plants. I have a mostly shady yard with perennial beds, and this year, maybe due to the moisture, I don't know, my lupins, hostas, hollyhocks, and some Irish eyes rudbeckia that I planted, they just look like lace. And I wonder what I can do to prevent that, and also will those plants come back, or have they been damaged too much?
When I hear lacy leaves, I always think first of Japanese beetles. But if you had Japanese beetles, you would know it because they eat and mate in broad daylight. So they're pretty evident. They're kind of a coppery green with little tufts of white hair around the back end. And they just eat like 300 to 500 species. And I was listening the other day when Ed Lyon was on and was talking about, yeah, we keep finding them trying new and different things in the garden. But they're pretty obvious, and they're popping up in new areas around the state, unfortunately. The good news is the plants will survive as long as they're otherwise good and healthy. It's just they don't look as pretty as we would like them to look. Old Brick Botanic Garden in Madison has a strategy where they just send out teams of, you know, volunteers that go out and knock the Japanese beetles into cups of soapy water, and that soapy water plugs the system where they exchange air, okay? So they basically suffocate and die. Morning is a good time because they tend to congregate, and even if you don't have Japanese beetles, I'm sure somebody listening is struggling with them. And boy, they can really do a lot of damage. And they do a very lacy, when they feed, it's very lacy in appearance. Slugs are usually a problem in shady conditions, and also earwigs, but they tend to eat larger holes in the leaves. They both feed typically in the evening, and with all the moisture we've had this year, both are big problems. What you may want to do is set out a straight-sided can, sink it in the ground with a little bit of beer, and the slugs are attracted to the fermenting yeast, so crawl inside and die. Very happy, but they'll be dead. And that's one way to manage them. There is a bait called Slug-O that I like because it's an iron phosphate, so it's not toxic. A lot of the slug baits are very, very toxic. This one, like, it's sold as Slug-O, Escargot. The active ingredient is iron phosphate. It poisons the slug, but it won't poison the toads or the birds that eat the poison slug. So that makes it a much more eco-friendly product to use. Earwigs are those skinny beetle-like insects with little pinchers on their back end.
Yeah, I have plenty of earwigs.
Okay,
no doubt
I know.
About that.
I had to move some planters in my car, and boy, when I took them out, there were lots of earwigs. I've been driving around the city with them too much lately. Those are a little bit tougher. The beer bait won't work on those, or the Slug-O. I had one gardener tell me about this strategy they saw in a botanic garden in Canada. They took the cylinder of cardboard inside the paper towel holder, filled it with straws, and then put packing tape around it to protect it from the weather and set it in the garden. The earwigs crawled in the straws, and in the morning, you go out, put your hands on either end of that paper towel holder to hold the earwigs in place. Have I lost you yet?
No.
And then you dump it into soapy water, and they'll drown and die. Otherwise, you'll want to use an insecticide label, a Rotenone or, some of those products that insecticidal soap may work, but usually as they get bigger, they're pretty resistant to that. I haven't really seen how effective neem, N as in Nancy, E-E-M as in Mary is on earwigs. Mm-hmm. But they also eat big holes. So those would be the three things I would look for.
Okay, I don't believe I have Japanese beetles.
That's good.
I would have seen those. And that's partly why I was calling, because I actually haven't seen any bugs. And I did spray the plants about a month ago pretty heavily with an insecticidal soap. But I will look for those things. I have one other question. I do use milorganite. I think it's fantastic. I use it broadly scattered on my lawn and my flower beds. I use it in the spring and the fall. Is that fine? Is that too much or too little?
Well, the nice part about it, not to sound like a commercial here, but it's a low nitrogen, slow release, and those are good timings, especially for your lawn. I tend to be a low fertilizer person, so I tend to work my beds in the spring, incorporate when I'm doing flowers and vegetable, and then if the plants look like they need a boost, then I'll do it. I avoid fertilizing perennials in the garden towards the end of the season. Once your trees and shrubs are dormant, that's another good time to fertilize. They don't really need a whole lot if you're using organic mulches, leaving your grass clippings. So, yeah, for lawn, definitely research out of Madison and other universities that said fall is the best time to fertilize.
Right.
Spring we do just to kind of give them that little nudge and help them through the summer.
Okay, thanks very much.
Thanks very much for calling. I have an email from Peggy in Mondovi, who planted a variety of sweet corn this year that grew quite tall. For some reason, the corn, which has pollen falling from the tassels onto the silk right now, is falling over. I've tried to stake some of it up, but once the stakes have fallen over, they bend and curve and probably won't straighten out again. I assume that corn stalks must be straight for gravity to take the pollen from the tassel to the silk. Will the kernels develop if the stalks are lodged? What do I do?
You do need to get that pollen. One of the things with corn is it's not falling directly down, and that's why we plant corn in blocks, is because it's wind pollinated, so typically it's blowing the pollen, and that's why you want at least a block by 4x4 so that as that pollen moves, it's not really typically falling right down on the same plant. They're pollinating each other. A lodging is very common in corn, sometimes with too much nitrogen, wet soils like we've had. Often they put a lot of top growth on and just can't support themselves. So lodging is fairly common in corn plants. And I hear a pain about trying to straighten it up. It seems kind of impossible at that point. There's nothing you can do but hope that there's enough out there that it's getting circulated enough that you'll get pollination.
Sue in La Crosse, on to you now. Hi, Sue.
Hi. I have just kind of a beginning gardener's question about deadheading.
Okay.
I have a variety of perennials, and I never know if should I always deadhead. Are there certain plants I should deadhead? Is there a rule of thumb about that?
You know, that's a great question. And one of the things is I'm a big believer in kind of matching my plants to my gardening style. And certain plants, like I find salvia to really look good and do well, really benefits from deadheading. If you don't, you'll still get a good display. And then if you cut it back when it starts getting floppy, then you'll get a later flush of bloom. And so the salvia in my garden do good. They do better in gardens where people do readily deadhead. In my month-by-month book, I do kind of some of the basics in terms of what's good for deadheading and cutting back to control size and height. For people who are avid perennial gardeners, Tracy DeSabato, and that's spelled D-I-S-A-B-A-T-O, Aust, A-U-S-T. Her book, The Well-Tended Perennial Garden, is great. She goes plant by plant, recommends, is there a benefit for deadheading? Is there a benefit for cutting back? So she goes through it. I don't recommend it for people who are very detail-oriented or brand-new gardeners because you'll read it and go, oh, I'll never have a garden. And if you do nothing, you're going to have a beautiful garden. If you do some selective deadheading, you'll get a better garden and some selective pruning. So if you kind of look at her book from that standpoint, that it's going to help you have an even more beautiful garden, but if you don't follow her guidelines, you're still going to have a beautiful garden. And then let the plants tell you. Things that bloom later in the season, we typically aren't doing much deadheading because they're going to be setting seed and winter's coming. Some of the plants that bloom later, like coneflowers, things that asters and mums that tend to get tall, if we prune them back early in the season, by the 4th of July, we can encourage more compact growth, delays the bloom a bit. So what some gardeners will do is they'll leave some of their coneflower, don't pinch them back. Then some of them they'll pinch back so they have staggered heights and staggered bloom times as well. And you're thinking, Melinda, I wanted an easy answer, not all this detail. So, and then things like daylilies. If you, as each flower fades, one fades a day, removing that flower will improve the appearance. It won't impact bloom. I'm one of those low-maintenance people, so I keep my daylilies back so I don't notice the faded flowers and I just see the blooming ones, you know. And those that like more neat and tidy will be out there picking off every faded flower each day so that they have a neat and tidy, better-looking plant.
All right.
Okay, thanks a lot.
And I was just going to mention, too, Larry, that on Melinda's Garden Moments, if you go in the archive, I did a section on deadheading and show you some of the different methods with spikes, with things like peonies that you won't get bloom, but you clean off the seed pods, coral bells, and some of the different types of blooms and how to deadhead those.
Perfect. Thanks again, Sue, for calling. And Jim in Luck, Wisconsin, we're on to you now. Hi, Jim.
Good morning. I have a question about fruit trees, and then if there's time, Larry, you can decide if I can ask the second question. My first question has to do with trying to determine what happened with all my trees are about 7-8 years old. Well, last August, one, I think it's an apple, it might be a pear, turned colors, real pretty colors like it would in the fall, and then the leaves turned black, and the tree died. And I may have that in two other apple trees.
And I can tell Larry knows the answer to this one, too, when he went cringe because we're both thinking fire blight.
Yeah.
Awesome. And pears are very susceptible. Apples will also get fire blight. And what you describe is a perfect description where the plant wilts. And I've seen trees go in a couple of days, and I've seen trees go branch by branch over time.
Uh-huh.
And one of the key things with fire blight, it's a bacteria, and it enters the plant in a couple different ways, through wounds. It splashes around by rain. Bees can transmit it when they're pollinating. And the key thing is with fire blight, when you're pruning out fire blight-infested branches, you want to look for a canker, a sunken, discolored area, and then you want to prune behind that at least 9 to 12 inches and then disinfect your tools between cuts. Because if you prune into a fire blight-infected branch and hit the disease, and you prune another branch, you'll spread the disease. I was in some small community, and this whole line of crab apples, you could tell they'd gone through and pruned, hit some fire blight, and everyone had it. You could just see where they'd made their cuts and had been infected. I would recommend that you send a sample in if you suspect the other ones are going, send a sample in to Brian Huddleston in the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic just to make sure it's not something else. There's not really much you can do. The Bactericides they used to have on the market, I think, are pretty much unavailable. And so pruning out infected branches, disinfecting your tools, that kind of thing to prevent damage is about really all you can do.
Yeah. Okay.
All right.
But I'd send a sample in. I don't know if you have a link from your website, Larry, but if you do, it's PDDC. Is it Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic? If you Google it, that's how I get there.
Actually, yeah, we have it out on my Facebook page. So if you go to the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page, you'll have it there.
I knew you would.
Okay. Have you got time for the second question?
Go ahead.
I have trees that are about 6 to 7 years old, as I mentioned, and they've gone through a lot of deer damage.
Okay.
They start with the leaves, and eventually they break branches. And I'm sure some of the trees have been killed by the deer, and we do have them fenced in now. But we've had a couple that died, we assume, from the deer damage. And when we dig them up, the roots like look almost the same as when we planted them.
Ooh.
And, of course, those are the ones that are going to die. But it makes me wonder, does the deer damage affect the root growth? And maybe it's been the dry weather or just something else.
You know, you bring up a whole good point. I always used to laugh that, you know, it's the plant doctor. My patient is doesn't speak and is already half buried underground, right? So it makes it hard. And looking at what happens to the underneath the ground is very important. What happens on top does influence root growth, but also how we plant our trees and how we prepare that planting hole is really important. And then that follow-up care, I think we always think that, you know, once we've got that plant in the ground, we've watered it, get it through a year, we're good. But we've had a couple of really dry seasons. You also add to that then the deer munching on the chlorophyll, you know, the leaves, which produce the energy. And if you're not getting the energy into the root system, then you really got problems and you're not going to see that root ball. So one of the things I would suggest if you start replacing these is make your planting hole wider, you know, 2 to 5 times wider than the root ball. And it doesn't have to be deep. It's just more like a saucer shape. So the same depth, so where the root flare comes out, you've got that's where the roots kind of flare away from the trunk to the root ball. That's the deepest part in the center, and then shallower on the edge, rough on the edges. What we find is that gives the roots a running start. They've done research and found that very successful. Mulching, wood chips, shredded bark, and water properly, and I think that'll help. And then protecting from the deer is really a good idea, too.
Yep.
And these trees were planted from
Were they bare root?
Dry root trees.
Yeah, bare root.
Bare root.
Okay. Yeah, with bare root, and that's just, so you still want to go wider, but, you know, carefully. And with bare root, water is even more important in getting those established. As you know, we had 2 very dry springs before this year. And, you know, if we weren't able to water, and the summers were pretty dry, so it was pretty tough.
Yep.
So even though they'd been in the ground a little while, they just may not have had enough energy, and then the deer didn't help either.
No.
Thanks a lot.
No, well, good luck, Jim.
Thanks, Jim, for calling. Lynette and Hubertus, let's turn to you now. Hi, Lynette.
Hi. I have a burning bush that is absolutely enormous, and I'm wondering, is there a way to bring it down to shrub size?
Yeah, I'm only laughing because it reminds me of back in the winter of 95, we had a lot of dieback. And before that time, I would say a burning bush that died back to a foot would be dead. Well, they recovered. That's not necessarily how you want to prune them back. But what I would suggest you do is look at the overall size and reduce it by no more than a third. And here's why. If you do a really harsh ground level or a couple feet above ground level pruning, you'll ruin the shape of the plant, create more wounds. But often what the plant does is put all that stored energy into new growth, and then you end up with a plant as big as you started. By taking a little bit off every year, you get a more gradual reduction of size. You don't get that big burst of regrowth. When you're pruning, I like more natural-shaped plants. That's my bias, and it's healthier for the trees and shrubs. But if you take a long branch back to a short branch and you make cuts like that, stagger it, that's also those wounds are going to close faster. You'll get better regrowth, not that big push of growth right underneath the cut. If you've ever seen a shrub that's been sheared, if you look right underneath where they cut, you'll see this proliferation of stems. you know, and then you get bare ankles, I call it, at the bottom, and all the growth at the top, and you end up with an ugly plant. So by doing your long branches back to shorter adjoining branches and selectively making those kind of cuts, you can keep a good-shaped plant, reduce the stress on the plant, and then do that over several years, and you can bring it down to size. And then, of course, you're going to have to keep after it.
Mm-hmm.
Can I do that now?
The best time to really prune is... it's really late winter. I just saw some research out of Germany, but the problem with doing it now is you might be who knows what's going to happen this fall.
Right.
I would do minimal touch-up pruning, but late winter, the wounds will close faster, and then you'll have some regrowth. You know, late winter, early spring, just as growth is going to begin, would be a better and less stressful time on the plant.
Mm-hmm. There you go.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Lynette. Ellen emailed us and wonders about her tomatoes. She said, my tomatoes seem to have lots of foliage, not so many fruits. Anything I can do right now?
I know, aren't we all? It's that first red tomato we all can't wait for. With the spring weather, I don't know about you, Larry, but my garden then, you know, telling everyone else what to do. I'm always the last one to get my tomatoes in. So my container tomatoes are doing good, but those I put in the ground a little late are I'm going to be waiting for. Make sure you're not over-fertilizing. You know, it's a matter of wait and see. There's really not much you can do to speed things up. The foliage, keep in mind that the leaves produce the energy that's going to form the flowers and the fruit, so you do not want to pull those off. Leave those on. And they also shade the fruit. There's an old saying that, you know, pull the leaves off to ripen your fruit faster. Well, that's how you get sunburned. So don't do that. Don't pull the leaves off. Leave them on. And with this warm weather, that's going to be the best thing for them. And unfortunately, it's a wait and see. And then always check when you're picking your tomatoes. Look for some of those shorter season tomatoes, too, and maybe even use some season extenders in the beginning of the season to kind of jumpstart them. I know that doesn't help right now, but maybe make a note on next year's calendar.
Let's turn to Frank in Arborvita next. Hi, Frank.
Ah, good day, folks.
Hi, Frank.
I got two raspberry questions for you.
Okay.
I just cut out all of the canes that bore fruit this year.
Okay.
And it looks to me like the new canes are kind of puny, more than I would expect them to be. Is it too late to put a little fertilizer in there?
If I did anything, I'd do something slow release. I think if I was you, I'd rather wait and do something late winter, early spring next year. Again, we want to make sure things harden off. And you know how fast raspberries can put on some growth. So, you know, we're getting to that cutoff time where I always get a little nervous, you know, if we get an early fall frost or, you know, the other thing I sometimes see if we do late season fertilization, it gets cool and then it gets warm and things pop again.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, at the most I do an organic low nitrogen slow release, but I would really prefer to wait till they go dormant, so either after they lose their leaves in the fall or spring.
Well, that's what I was thinking, but I thought I'd check with you.
Now,
the second question
sometimes is a good thing, Frank.
Second question is, I noticed a number of canes, new canes, where the tip is got stopped and black, as though something bit it or stung it or something. Do you know what that's all about?
I talked earlier about some of the cane borers that as they feed, you'd see more of a wilting, but that can also turn into a black discoloration. I know I was listening to you, Larry, the other day when Brian was on, and he talked about a few viruses, but typically that's more viral diseases are more light and dark green and more weird patterns and more stunted growth. The black tip to me might be, I'd check along that stem, see if you see any holes, if you see any swollen spots. Extension, UW Extension has a great bulletin on growing raspberries in Wisconsin. If you have access to the Internet, it's free to download it. Great line drawings, and they have some pictures of some of the damage. And that may, you know, I always find pictures show it so much better than you trying to translate what I'm describing. But I would look for any swollen areas that might indicate some bore problems that are blocking the flow and causing those tips to wilt and then maybe turn black.
There you go.
Thank you.
Thanks, Frank. Good luck with those raspberries.
Thanks a lot for calling. Melinda Myers, our guest today on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Horticulture expert Melinda Myers, our guest today. And again, if you want to take a look at her website, it's melindamyers.com. And Myers is spelled M-Y-E-R-S. Take a look at it. It's beautiful with lots of great information. And we have a question from Diane, who emailed us, Melinda. She said, when can I cut off my peonies after they're done blooming?
You know, in terms of deadheading your peonies, you can, when those flowers fade, you can go ahead and prune them. Some people like the look of the seed heads. Some people don't. Also, it can weigh them down sometimes. So sometimes when we clip those off, it makes the plant spring back up if you have one of those that tends to fall over. You want to leave the leaves intact, so you're just going to prune off those faded flowers. So when they're done blooming, they're done blooming. And, you know, deadheading won't prolong the flowering, but it just kind of makes them neat and tidy. And in terms of the foliage, leave them on till the frost kills it back in the fall.
Bob in Lindenhurst, your turn. Hi, Bob.
Hi. I have four false indigo plants.
Okay.
24. Go ahead.
Oh, no, good. No, sorry. We're just helping each other agree here. Okay.
Two plants are 24 inches tall approximately, and two are 18. They're about 5 years old. The third year, they had a profusion of flowering. And the last 2 years, maybe 25 or 10% of the plant flowered compared to when it was at its best. What do I do differently than what I'm doing at this time?
Are these in sun or shade?
They're in sun.
Okay, good. What's your soil like? Do you have sandy soil, heavier soils?
Heavier soil.
Okay. False indigo is the perennial plant of the year, and I know what you're thinking, Bob. Everyone you see is like 4 or 5 feet tall and wide, big plants covered with blooms, and then those blooms turn into these nice black seed pods, which are cool in arrangements and neat in the garden. How are the plants around it in that area doing?
The plants are doing false indigo plants themselves are immense. The plant itself is huge.
Oh, I thought you said they were 24 inches tall and 18 inches tall.
Yeah. Well, I'd say the taller, there were two different varieties that we purchased, and the taller one is maybe 36 inches tall.
Okay. Okay. What kind of fertilizing are you doing?
Yeah, nothing more than Miracle-Gro.
Okay. One of the things I would do is stop with the Miracle-Gro, and the reason being is it tends to push the nitrogen. Baptisia are in the legume family, and they tend to fix nitrogen from the atmosphere, the peas, the beans, and all of those. And so that means they don't need a lot of fertilizer.
Okay.
They're getting it themselves. So I would stop fertilizing, because if they get too much nitrogen, as you know, then they get lots of leaf growth and stem growth, but no flowers. So I would stop fertilizing. If you top dress with compost occasionally, that's great, but I would stop the Miracle-Gro and let them go, and I bet you'll see an improvement next year in bloom.
Excellent, because the plants are wonderful, and I've seen plants that are blooming beautifully, as mine did 3 years ago, and I'd love to have it back like that again.
No, I don't blame you. I hear you. So just less is better in this case. So
thanks, Bob. Thanks a lot for calling. Lori and Krivitz, we're on to you. Hi, Lori.
Hello. I'm primarily trying to stick with native plants where I live, and I was wondering what ones you would suggest. And I was wondering if all sedums are native. They've got the ground cover type, and then they have the upright. And I was also, like, non-native plants, which I'm assuming are non-native, like snake root, astilbe, Russian sage. Those, are they invasive? Are any of those invasive?
Okay, a really good question. I don't know of any native sedums that are out there. So I would throw those in with the... And if there's someone out there listening that knows differently, please correct me. So I would throw those in with the ornamentals. Russian sage, I haven't had real problems with, but some gardeners who have really good, well-drained soils will see they'll send out runners and occasionally seedlings. So you might, they're not rated as invasive. When I call a plant invasive, it's a plant that escapes the garden and invades our native space. Aggressive is a plant, for me, this is kind of how I separated that, it takes up more than its fair share of the garden. And you may end up weeding it out, but it's not escaping into our natural areas. It's just annoying and taking over your garden space. And that can happen with native plants, too, because DNR has a good part of their website on invasive plants, and they talk about what's invasive. And they even list some native plants. Gray dogwood, for example, is on their list because it gets going and it can colonize an area. So you want to make sure you want that much of the plant. So invasive is one issue. Native, looking for a good source. There are a lot of good native seed companies in our area, particularly looking at prairie plants for sunny areas. So looking at things like switchgrass, however, if you get our native switchgrass, get it from the region, but it can reseed. So I'll use cultivars of switchgrass in a landscape setting. Some people would argue that's not native. Some people would say it is. So you kind of have to have your own definition. Spirabilis, which is prairie drop seeds, being used a lot. Wonderful smell of, well, I guess, burnt popcorn maybe isn't a wonderful smell, but very fragrant. And I was just in Chicago for the International Society of Arboriculture, and if you haven't been to downtown Chicago, you need to walk around because they're doing some really cool plantings. And they were using a lot of the prairie drop seed, which is a native, and mixing it with non-native. And so finding a blend that way. You know, there's a lot of things like veronicastrum, and I'm trying to think of the culver's root, which has white spiky flowers. Bugbane or snake root is a great shade plant, and it's native in parts around the Appalachian Mountains, southern Ohio. Fringe bleeding heart is native in the Appalachian Mountains, not so much here. There's a book called Vegetation of Wisconsin for those folks that like a more scientific approach and what's truly native to Wisconsin. It's not an easy read. It's a good reference kind of book as well. And in my garden book for Wisconsin, I try to talk about native relatives of some of the common garden plants, just for people that were looking for something more native. But I would go on, where did I find a good source that listed native plant sources? I think I just did a Google native plant nurseries in Wisconsin. Check mm-hmm. with your local, if you have a local nature center. That would be a good option, and then that can tell you places that are providing the native plants as well. And then look at matching them just like you would any plant with the growing conditions, because whether it's native or not.
I was wondering that the purple snake root, now you mentioned snake root, is that?
Well, what I know is it used to be Simisifuga. Now it's Actea. Do you know the botanical name of the plant? I just want to make sure we're talking. The purple one with the purple foliage is a cultivar.
Okay.
So it depends on your definition of native. And I throw that back out there because I could probably bring 10 people that use native plants in a room and they'd all have a slightly different definition. And so I think you're on the right track, though. You don't want anything invasive. You know, you want something suited to the growing conditions. And then if you're looking for a native plant, it needs to, you know, also fit that criteria. And then finding it is always a challenge. Larry, always check the listings, because I know Larry has quite a few people on that sell native plants.
Yes.
As well, because I find the source is going to be one of your bigger challenges.
Prairie Nursery is a good one, for example.
Right, Westfield and you've got Prairie Future. So, yeah, those are great places to see what's available, mostly by seed, but there are plants. And more garden centers are carrying natives as well and labeling them as such.
So there you have it, Lori. Thank you very much and good luck.
Thank you.
Yeah, appreciate the call. Victoria in Mount Horeb, your turn. Hi, Victoria.
Hi.
What can we do for you?
My question is about cultivated bee balm. Is that an invasive plant?
Well, I haven't heard it be classed as invasive, but if you've grown it, you know it's definitely aggressive.
It is, yeah.
And I haven't heard that it's invading natural areas and crowding out our native bee balm.
Mm-hmm.
Great for hummingbirds, great for butterflies. I always tell people that one of my favorite things is when I'm thinning it out in the spring, it smells so good that, you know, it's kind of a wonderful addition there. And then looking for those that are powdery mildew resistant, too.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it does mix well with the native bee balm, and I just stand there and I watch the bees and the hummingbirds, and it's wonderful. But it's very happy in my 6 acres.
I have not read anything, and I really try hard to keep up on that, but I'm honest, they keep adding new plants all the time.
Okay.
And there is a good U.S. government, if you just put in a plant name and put invasive, it usually kicks you into the government plant list. DNR is always a good place to start for Wisconsin, but that one gives you a good indication of what's happening around the country, which sometimes can give you ideas of what may be heading our way as well.
Yeah. All right. I was just worried I started the hot spot.
that your name would be plastered on
be...
a turf fault, right?
Great. Thank you.
Thanks so much.
Thanks a lot for calling. We got an email from Mary who says, I wonder if Melinda has it backwards. Here's an extension information on this relating to onions.
Oh, good. Thank you, Mary. I probably do. So please, I was going to try that. Thank you, Mary. So tell me, what did you find, Mary?
Northern gardeners should plant long day onions.
That's where I started, and I rethought it. So good. Thanks.
The daylight length varies greatly as you get further and further away from the equator. Winter days are very short, but summer days are long. Long day onions will have a chance to produce lots of top growth, hence produce bigger bulbs before the day length triggers bulbing.
Thank you, Mary, and thank you. And Bob, I hope you're listening. I was going to look in and try to go through a commercial break and look it up, so we'll all remember South and Short both start with S's. I'm going to remember that. Thank you, Mary, for helping me out here. I really appreciate it.
And then coming up in a week, a big event. It is National Sneak Some Zucchini on Your Neighbor's Neighbor's Porch Day. August 8th is National Sneak Some Zucchini on Your Neighbor's Porch Day, according to the Wisconsin State Journal this morning.
I love it. That is great. That is just wonderful. That is too funny. I also want to just plug that I'll be at the Wisconsin State Fair. I speak there twice a day every day, and we redid some gardens, so we've got some fun things. We mixed vegetables with some of the new ornamental varieties and flowers to fill up space between shrubs, and I'm there from 9:45 and at 2 at the We Energy Park, and we're doing kids' activities every day at 11:15. So I hope folks will come by and visit with me, too.
Okay. And again, the times for that?
9:45 and 2 p.m. at the We Energy Park is when I'll be speaking. And then 11:15 is when we'll be doing some worm composting with kids and taking cuttings and doing some things. And then there's also this fun event for people that are, you know, fans of, like, you know, cook-offs and things. They're doing this with the florists. There's the Grand Champion Floral Challenge. And so they're going to have a design-off, so to speak, on Saturday, August 7th at noon at the Horticulture Building. And I'll be there. So someone will be filling in with the kids.
All right. Melinda Myers of Milwaukee, our horticulture expert here on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Melinda Myers, horticulture professional, author of many books. She's got her own great website, melindamyers.com. Great to have her along today, and thank you for listening in as well. Join us at 1-800-642-1234 with your questions. And let's turn to Gary in Franklin next. Gary, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Two quick questions. Tomatoes. I went to be becoming a container gardener the last couple of years and have good success. This year, however, a lot of yellowing of the bottom leaves, browning, patching, and they're falling off. A little more premature than they would. Any thoughts on this?
Yeah. Do you have good drainage holes in your containers?
Yeah. I did not plug them up.
That's good.
There's five or six good holes in there.
So. Did you start with fresh potting mix, or do you make your own, or what kind of potting
mix? Well, I combined my own, but it was all fresh this year.
Okay.
It was leaf mold and a packaged potting mix.
Okay.
Have you fertilized at all?
Yes, I have.
Okay. A slow release, a quick release?
They were small, slow release. It was a Miracle-Gro product.
Okay. So, like the Osmocote that gives you, like, I think it's 6 to 9 months it's supposed to give you?
Right.
Okay.
Right.
Okay. Those are all the first things in terms of environmental. With the heat and extreme watering, you may want to just, usually nutrient deficiency or yellowing, things like that. There are some disease problems also. Septoria leaf spot can be a problem where you get yellow leaves and then really circular brown spots, starts from the bottom and works its way up.
Mm-hmm.
And you will get some leaf drop eventually. That can be an issue. Picking off the infected leaves, copper-containing fungicides will help with that to at least slow it down. Usually you still get tomatoes. The plants just look really ugly by the end of the season.
Right,
obviously reduced production. So that's a possibility. Is the fruit looking fine that's on there? It's just the leaves that are yellowing?
No, it's just the leaves. It's just a vegetative, and it's just a lower third. Most of the plants have good fruit. They're ripening. Everything looks fine. I'm removing the stems, you know, with a sharp pair of shears as they become more and more infected, you know, looking that bad. But the fruit so far is fine, and the top half of the vegetative growth is very green yet. So.
You know what? If they're not circular spots and it doesn't look like the fruit's being impacted, it's hard without seeing it. But my first reaction was the same as Larry's, is fertilization.
Right.
And it might be worth just doing, you know, again, something very low nitrogen, slow release, because you don't want to push it at this point because it is fruiting, and see if that makes a difference.
Okay.
A foliar feed, sometimes they're not really good at giving you the nutrients they need, but sometimes it gives you the quick green up at least a little bit so you see a difference. But you might want to give it a little nutrient boost. It may be with all this rain and all the heat we're having that your slow release is not lasting as long because of the weather conditions.
Okay. And one more quick one, if I could. Endless summer hydrangeas.
Yes.
For the last 4 years, people walk by my house and stop and look and gawk. They're just beautiful flowering. This year, I have all vegetative growth and little or none, no flowering at all.
Well, one, pat yourself on the back, because you're one of the few people that's told me they've had great success. I was going to rip mine out this year because I haven't had a lot of good flowers, because I find they really need a little more TLC than I give them, a little more nutrients in the spring. I tend not to fertilize. Good moisture, which we had good moisture this year.
Yeah.
So I was going to rip mine out. They bloomed finally. So, what do you do now, right?
Yeah.
So maybe I stole that from you. The thing I would just keep in mind, it sounds like for some reason, I don't know if the heat took them out, if they're in a little bit of a sunnier spot with the extreme heat we've had. For me, the moisture this spring really gave them what they needed in my garden. So it sounds like what you do is the right thing because you've had luck up to this point.
Right.
Have you changed your fertilization at all?
No, I was using aluminum sulfate just to change color on the blooms a little bit, and I was using just like a 10-10-10, a general fertilizer. But going back on my logs a little bit, I haven't fertilized the last year or so.
You might want to give it just, you know, next spring, give it a little boost, because I just find that they need a little more nutrients than most shrubs.
Sure.
And then that moisture is critical. And we've got plenty of moisture this year,
right.
And so you may just want to give them a boost next year.
Okay. Yeah, they're record vegetative growth. I mean, they're probably 10, 12 inches higher than I've ever had them.
Yeah, they're putting,
You know,
yeah, so you might want to do, you know, the one reason I like the Milorganite is the phosphorus. It releases phosphorus in the soil, where a lot of our 10-10-10, the phosphorus gets tied up in the soil and is not available to the plant, and that helps boost flowering. So you might want to, you know, try using that to see if that can also help switch things back to flower instead of foliage growth.
Okay, what is that again? Which
it's called Milorganite, Milorganite, or some other organic, low-nitrogen organic fertilizers. A lot of the organics, it shows that when the microorganisms work on it, it helps to release that phosphorus in the soil. They've just done research on this particular one, so I know it works on this one.
Yeah.
And I've just seen some really amazing results from some of the research out of Florida.
Thanks, Gary. Good luck. Appreciate your call. Susan in Wyawega, on to you now. Hi, Susan.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
My husband and I have an established prairie over 20 years old, and it's a tall grass prairie.
Excellent.
The soil is clay, and it's probably not quite an acre. Plus, we have some in the land we own behind us. So we do have some knowledge about prairies and native landscaping. This year, we have Queen of the Prairie, which is sort of close to the house, and it grew up really well, and we've been really pleased with it for the last years. However, this year, in the spring, and it was probably in May, the leaves withered and dried up and died back, and it's starting to come back. There's three different areas also, and they're close to the house. They're within close proximity to each other, but wondering if maybe you've heard anything that might have been happening with other Queen of the Prairie.
Now, you said they're in three different areas, and all three areas are affected?
Yes.
Okay. And did you, I mean, No, I haven't heard of anything. Usually weather-related. I have seen the Filipendulinas, which Queen of the Prairie is, do exactly what you're saying, wither away and come back. It's usually more moisture, soil moisture-related.
Okay.
We get lots of rain, though, which is the weird thing. You know, with you might get some root rot. I don't know if that's an area that tended to stay wet. You know, I know the Queen of the Prairie also takes fairly moist soils, but if it was pretty wet and soggy, depending on how the rainfall was in that
area. Yeah, well, I'm not sure that it might have had anything to do with it, but it seemed to me in my perception that it occurred right after a really large rainstorm.
Okay.
And there was hail in that storm.
Oh.
So you don't think it would be anything that was...
If it was diseased,
yeah.
I would expect it not to be coming back.
Okay.
If it's showing signs of growth, I would definitely keep an eye on it. Again, we've got a great disease diagnostic clinic. You might just want to, you know, shoot a note. I have not heard anything going on with them. I'm kind of one of those people sometimes that just monitors and watches, and if things are starting to recover, it's a good indication that it's probably more environmental.
Okay.
If it was a life-threatening disease, I would think it would be dead and stay that way.
And stay that way.
Yeah.
Is there anything we can do to encourage its growth?
We want to help things, but less is better. And, you know, just let it recover on its own. Again, as I'd mentioned earlier, sometimes fertilizing damaged, stressed plants could be more harmful than good. You know, if you feel you need to do something, top dressing with some compost, homemade compost would be great.
That's not possible because it's naturally landscaped, so it's in with the
so it
grasses
have a whole
the,
big prairie
other,
area.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so then you've got all that organic matter. So
yes. The
only thing I would do is, as you're kind of monitoring, just to see if that drainage is any different, if moisture collects differently, you know, or if it drains off faster, you know, even though it's all the same, you know, soil varies from 1 foot to the next and drainage patterns. So I think you'll be amazed it'll come back.
Okay.
It's starting to show signs of recovery. And then again, listen in when Larry has some of his native plant guests on as well, or when Brian's on too.
Yeah.
I always learn a lot from him. So.
Okay.
There you go, Susan.
Oh, thank you so much.
Thanks for calling.
We have an email from Diana, who has an Amur maple as a focal point in a small garden visible from her kitchen window. The maple branches from the main trunk branch into five main branches. One has sun scald. It's a large main branch, so I hate to remove it and set the plant off balance. However, I'm afraid if I don't, I might put the tree at risk of disease or damage. The damaged branch is very prominent and visible from the window. What would you do?
Okay, so I'm going to make some assumptions here. I'm assuming she sees the damage on the trunk. If the leaves are full size, you might, and it's critical to the shape, you might want to leave it. Typically where we worry about sun scald and frost cracking is the damage to the branch, and then you see reduced size of the leaves, early fall color, and that branch eventually goes. And so I'm guessing she's seeing a crack or crevice. I have a big street tree, a Norway maple street tree, came with my house, but it gives me my shade for the summer. And I've got a huge frost crack on there, but I have a bed underneath with mulch. I make sure it gets water during extended drought. You know, kind of keep an eye on it to keep the plant healthy. You know, I would say if the leaves are fine and full-sized, you know, Amur maples are also considered an invasive plant. So if you end up pruning it to ground level, I wouldn't replace it with another one. I know they're beautiful. The flowers are fragrant, great, great, beautiful plants. I would probably leave it unless it's a detriment. If it's dying back, the leaves are small-sized, then I'd prune it. But then you have to decide, is the tree going to look so ugly for so long?
Right.
That it's time to replace it. And then if it was a bigger tree, I'd probably bring in a certified arborist. And the reason being, if it was a bigger tree with a big branch that was showing signs of stress, if that branch went, would it hurt somebody, property, or cause damage or really wipe out the rest of the plant? And they can check for soundness, and they have equipment to do that. So in such a small tree, unless it looks really ugly, I would leave it.
Okay. Mike in Germantown, we're on to you now. Hi, Mike.
thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I just had a quick question. I have an earth box, actually three earth boxes that I ordered offline. I'm not sure if Melinda's aware,
I know she's heard about those.
I planted tomatoes in one and beans and peas in the other. Now, in the beginning of the season, they were growing great. My tomatoes far exceeded all my friends' tomatoes, and they grew wonderfully, and they look great, very healthy. About a month ago, I started getting small millimeter-sized black ants all over my beans and peas, ate them, basically cut the stems off. I eventually cut the stems off myself and removed them because there's no foliage growing. And then they moved on to my tomatoes, and they're starting to burrow into the tomatoes, and they're basically ruining my fruits. I'm sort of a naturalist, so I was wondering, what is a natural way to get rid of these ants, and why are they targeting my tomatoes?
Yeah, really. Typically, ants are protein or sweet eaters, and so we often see ants when we have a lot of aphids. And I don't know if you've noticed any aphids feeding on your plants. And what happens with aphids is they suck plant juices, secrete the excess. It's a clear, sticky substance called honeydew, and so they often work in conjunction because the aphids are providing food that the ants like. And we often see the ants because they're bigger and more obvious than the aphids.
So the first thing would have been to remove the aphids then.
Right. An insecticidal soap is considered by most organic growers a great way to do it. It's soap that they've tested, So that's one thing. Overripe fruit might be, you know, if your fruit's cracking or what, that might be going in. I've never heard or seen ants chewing on stems.
No, they're after the sap.
Yeah, and so they may be.
My next question. I also have a rabbit problem, and I was wondering.
Yeah.
It's more in my butterfly garden. I was wondering if there's a plant that attracts butterflies and hummingbirds, yet deters deer and.
There's a two-letter answer for that.
Exactly. That is one of the challenges. And I think as a naturalist garden, you probably like the wildlife, too, that comes in the birds, the butterflies.
Right.
And the rabbits are great if they're in the neighbor's yard eating and just hopping through yours,
as long as
right?
they're not in my garden.
Yeah, there's a relatively new animal deterrent that I've heard some really good things from both professionals and gardeners called Bobex, B-O-B-B-E-X.
Okay.
And it's all natural material, so you can use it on food crops, which a lot of products you can't. So Bobex, B-O-B-B-E-X, and it's got some garlic, some fish emulsion that they found helps it stick, acts as a spreader sticker, and some other plant-derived products. And, with any kind of repellent, you want to try to do it before they start feeding. It's easier to prevent them, break a habit, and then repeat. But this tends to have a longer residual. And, again, you can use it on food crops. So that might be helpful. Fencing's always your surefire, but, you know, that's not always practical either.
Right.
There you go. Thanks, Mike.
Good luck. And, I think the rabbits are probably doing the munching. The ants are doing the honeydew, and they're probably just more visible. And it sounds like you have a whole ecosystem in those earth boxes.
Dan in Sheboygan, we're on to you. Hi, Dan.
Hi. I had a question about mushrooms on my lawn. And, I have small children, and I also don't really like them on my lawn, so I was wondering what I could do.
You know, really, probably not the easiest. Here's the deal. The mushrooms are the fruiting body of fungus that's in the soil, and that fungus is working on decaying wood, so old tree roots maybe that might be dying back. You know, sometimes I see it on newly built homes that maybe some scrap lumber or wood got blended into the soil, and the fungus is feeding on it. And then we've had so much rain this year that when it's moist, that's when those mushrooms tend to pop. A lot of people will just take a rake and break up the mushrooms to try to break them apart so kids are less likely to eat them, because that's really the big fear that we have. And they don't look good. You're right.
there are Frank Rossi, who used to be our extension turf specialist, had talked about a few, had told me about some fungicides that you can use. The problem is, I always worry that, you know, then we're setting off the natural fungi that are in the soil,
right.
And it's expensive, and I don't even know if you can buy these commercially. So I'm more of the attitude of, as soon as they're done eating that decaying wood, then it won't be a problem. When the food source is gone, they're gone. So you may just want to take a rake. You know, when it's rainy, you know they're going to be popping up. Just get a rake and break it up or cut them off and throw them away to keep the kids away. That's really, I think, the best bet.
Thanks, Dan, for calling. And Jack in La Crosse, on to you. Hi, Jack.
Hey, Larry. Hi, Melinda. Thanks
Hi,
for taking
Jack.
My call, and I love your show. I have a pear tree that I planted about three, four years ago, and it's never bore any fruit. Can you help me?
Yeah. Do you know if it's a standard or a dwarf pear?
I'm not sure. I think it's a standard pear.
Okay. With dwarf fruit trees, you tend to get fruit forming earlier in several years. For the more standard pears, it can take even up to 5 or 6 years to get fruit, good fruit production. So that's one thing. Secondly, most of our fruit trees don't need a lot of fertilization. Okay, too much fertilizer, lots of leaf and stem growth, not a lot of fruit production. So I don't know if you've done any fertilizing.
No, I haven't done any fertilizing.
Okay,
and like I said, I think it's 4 years. Maybe it's only 3 years it's
okay.
been in the ground. So
did you get any flowers at all?
Another year or two, huh?
Okay, did you get any flowers at all?
You know, I travel quite a little bit also, and
okay.
so I may have missed them, but no, I didn't see any.
Okay, and the other thing is pruning. Have you started training it to open it up for good light penetration and air circulation?
I did do that this year, yes.
Okay. Sometimes, also, if you did a lot of heavy pruning, that also can sometimes trigger more vegetative growth and not flowering. So you needed to start training it. So it's good that you start doing it. I would give it another year and not be too concerned that you haven't seen flowering. We really prefer that you don't get flowers the first few years and have fruit, and we usually tell you to pick them off if you get them, because we want that plant to get established and then start fruiting. So you're okay. I would worry if it was a couple years later. I think it's good you pruned. Watch for, I think, maybe have somebody check if you're on the road during bloom time to see if you're getting flowers. But I wouldn't be too concerned at this point, and they're still pretty young.
Thanks for calling, Jack. And Shireen in Springbrook, we'll go to you now. Hi.
Hi. We found a solution for mushrooms in the lawn when we had little children.
Okay.
We taught them. It was a great game to run and stomp on them.
I love it. Thank you. You know, that is great. That's, you know, that's wonderful. Thank you.
I like that idea. Jeff and Racine has a couple of butternut squash plants in his garden. They've begun to develop a white mildew on a couple
okay.
of their leaves. What do I do?
Yeah, it's powdery mildew. And boy, are we seeing a lot of it this year, not only on squash and zucchini, but, phlox and Monarda bee balm and a lot of other plants. Perfect powdery mildew. You need to decide if you still have quite a bit of growing time. And why we worry about powdery mildew is it forms on the leaf surface. It blocks the sunlight. It prevents it from reaching the leaves that produce the energy, and that's when you then get some yellowing and browning and dieback. There are some fungicides labeled for use on fruits and vegetables for powdery mildew. University of Cornell found that baking soda was very effective. 1 tablespoon of baking soda, 1 teaspoon of either insecticidal soap or a lightweight horticulture oil. Those act as a spreader sticker in a gallon of water. And then you're going to need to repeat it throughout the season. And then neem, N as in Nancy, E-E-M as in Mary, is another organic option. Make sure you get the formulation for disease control and check that it's labeled for that. If you want to control it, that will help slow it down, take care of the disease. And they're okay to use on food crops, too.
All right. There you have it. And boy, we're about out of time. And I know we had a lot of questions we didn't get to. And If you have a question and you didn't get on today, you are encouraged, aren't they, Melinda, to call their questions to you, and then you put them in a podcast sometimes.
Exactly. So, So if you call and leave a message, and then I'll answer that in upcoming podcast, and we'll do that. And the other thing, the fun project that I've been doing is garden tours at our local botanic garden, Berner Botanical Garden. But I'm also posting photos and doing a podcast related. So if you can't join me in person, you can still see what's blooming at Berner and hopefully get some ideas you can use in your own backyard. So just visit my website and you can join me for that garden tour as well.
And that's MelindaMyers.com, and Myers is spelled M-Y-E-R-S.
You bet. And if you misspell, we'll usually be able to get you there. But thanks, Larry. That always increases the odds of success.
I misspelled it myself once, and it still popped up. So
it did. Yeah, I know everybody does. So thank you. I really appreciate it, and I really appreciate the opportunity to come in and chat. And I'll be posting some pictures on my Facebook from Ball Seed Company so you can see some of the new and exciting things that I've been able to see today.
Thanks, Melinda.
Okay, thanks so much. Have a great weekend.
You too. Melinda Myers, our guest, and she'll be back. We'll have her on again, I'm sure. Join my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show, and thanks for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network.